Welcome to the Sonic Landscape STL Podcast, Episode 1, Ragtime.
I'm Molly Rose.
And I'm Sam Monroe.
In this episode, we will be introducing you to the history of ragtime music in St. Louis.
And one of the most famous St. Louis ragtime musicians, Scott Jumblin.
Later on, we will be talking with Jess O'Brien, who has generously agreed to share her knowledge on Scott Jumblin. But first, what is ragtime, Sam?
Well, Molly, ragtime is a musical genre for the piano and is often considered an early form of jazz. In the word ragtime, time is used as a suffix which describes the type of music by the characteristics of its rhythm. The initial form of ragtime was simple, but became more complex and serious after the end of the first decade of the 20th century.
The term is a contraction for its characteristically ragged rhythm, which indicates that the melody is broken up into short, syncopated rhythms while a steady beat is played on the piano or implied on the banjo.
In addition to pianos, ragtime also popularized player pianos, which featured rolls that the public could buy to hear the latest ragtime tunes. There were few phonograph recordings of piano solos, so these piano rolls were essential in disseminating ragtime music, especially for the non-piano playing public. Sheet music, however, was far larger and it was less expensive.
The first 20 years of the 1900s, ragtime was everywhere, and the most famous names associated with ragtime were Joseph Lamb, James Scott, and St. Louis's very own Scott Jumblin.
We know that one of the first published ragtime compositions was released in 1897 and was titled Mississippi Rag. Let's listen.
You know, Sam, St. Louis played a prominent role in the creation and publication of rags, and is known as the heartland of ragtime.
Really?
Yep. Tom Turpin, a self-taught pianist and ragtime musician, composed Harlem Rag in 1897 in St. Louis. A few years later, in 1900, he opened the Rosebud Saloon on Market Street, and it wasn't long before it became the hotspot of ragtime. Turpin is known for composing St. Louis Rag in 1903.
Another important contributor for ragtime was publisher John Stark. Originally from Sedalia, Missouri, Stark moved to St. Louis after the successful publication of Scott Jumblin's Maple Leaf Rag in 1899. Maple Leaf Rag was very successful and sold over 1 million copies by 1914.
Oh, wow.
He would go on to publish other famous ragtime musicians such as Joseph Lamb and James Scott. Although Lamb and Scott were highly influential ragtime composers, it was Scott Joplin's published works which propelled Stark's business.
Like Stark, Jumblin moved to St. Louis and settled in 2658 Delmar Boulevard in 1901, renting a room there for 2 years. During this time, he taught piano and composed several rags. Among the most famous was The Entertainer. The house is still standing today and has been converted into the Scott Jumblin House State Historic Site, which stands to preserve the history of Scott Joplin's life and legacy.
Here to tell us more about Scott Jumblin is Jess O'Brien. Jess currently volunteers at the Scott Jumblin House as a temporary seasonal historian, and she holds a master's degree in history. Jess, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm really excited to be here.
All right, to start this off, I was just going to ask, who was Scott Jumblin, and when did he settle in St. Louis?
Okay, so I would like to begin by quoting the late Brian Cather, my dear friend and coworker, who's a vital contributor to our work at the museum. And he quoted, Scott Joplin was a highly driven, ambitious American composer at the turn of the 20th century who sought to create a distinct and distinctive American classical music built upon African-American musical traditions. He elevated ragtime piano music to an unprecedented degree of musical excellence in much the same way that European composers elevated musical ideas of their native lands to similarly unprecedented artistic levels. End his quote. In the 1890s, before arriving in St. Louis, Joplin settled in Sedalia, Missouri. He then relocated to St. Louis around 1901. He lived in two other locations while in St. Louis, one on Locust Street and one other on Market Street, before moving to New York in 1907.
Awesome. Thank you.
So when Scott Joplin settled in Delmar, what rags did he compose while he lived at the house?
So rags were published at the end of each year. So we're unsure exactly what months he moved into the house during 1901 and out during 1903. But it's safe to say that the publications from 1902 were most likely composed while living at this address. Some of the publications from 1901 include the Peachering Rag and the Easy Winners, along with Sunflower Slow Drag, which was a collaboration with Scott Hayden. Published in 1902 were Cleopha, The Strenuous Life, A Breeze from Alabama, Elite Secret Patience, The Entertainer, and The Ragtime Dance. And I always like to point out that it's pretty rad The Entertainer was composed in this actual house, because that's usually, one of the only ones that people know.
Mm-hmm. But The Strenuous Life, I know there's isn't there a book upstairs in the collections that's...
Yes. So that is for Teddy Roosevelt.
Mm. Okay.
All right, so it seems like he was pretty influential in the area. Could you tell me what impact he had on St. Louis and ragtime?
Sure. So on October 24th, 1901, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch published an article called What is Ragtime? In this article, several musicians are asked to share their opinions on St. Louis being a ragtime city. Ms. Blair remarked, and I quote, that the World's Fair city is in reality only a ragtime city, end quote. Ernest Kroger, who was the member of the Bureau of Music for the St. Louis World's Fair, stated, and I quote, but the ragtime song, they are unbearable. They have reached the rock bottom of indecency, end quote. So the same negative attitude can be seen in several other musician statements in the article. Other comments, which were largely negative, were made in regard to the overall taste in music by local St. Louisans. So basically, St. Louisans have bad taste in music because the city is known for ragtime. In my opinion, Scott Joplin is the reason those comments were made. He is the reason that St. Louis was put on the map for being the ragtime city mentioned in the article. St. Louis's central location makes it a great place for musicians to congregate and share their music. The river helps disseminate that music culture up and down the center of the country. I don't think Joplin and ragtime just impacted St. Louis. Even in Joplin's day, his music spread over to Europe, where he was even supposed to play concerts, which ended up falling through. But despite all the hate, people really liked ragtime. I mean, you can't help but dance to it. Ragtime was just the rock and roll of the early 1900s. It was the devil's music. I found it fascinating to see an ad for his music to be played at a concert in Oakland, California, as early as 1907. That was pretty impressive. Tom Turpin's Rosebud Cafe in Chestnut Valley was St. Louis's ragtime hub, and folks came from all over the country to compete in piano competitions. St. Louis was just right for ragtime. Sedalia was a little small and New York was a little big, but St. Louis had just the right mixture of talent and was located right in the heart of the country.
So the 1904 World's Fair in St. Louis, we know John Philip Sousa played there, but Scott Joplin was also there as well. Could you tell us a little bit more about how he was received?
Yes. So you mentioned Scott Joplin being at the fair. Mm-hmm. Do you have sources to indicate that he was at the fair?
Well, I guess I'd be going off of
the 1977 movie, which said that he was there. But we now know a little bit more that that is not so historically accurate.
Yeah, so that's not historically accurate. So this happens to be what I spent my summer researching. And this whole semester, I researched perspectives of ragtime at the World's Fair. So we'll break this down into a couple parts. So this is more about how ragtime was received at the fair. I'll touch base on the issue of Joplin's attendance at the fair in a moment. But ragtime was initially banned at the fair.
Oh, wow.
So many articles all over the country talk about this. There's many of the same types of articles that mention this ban. So the Tacoma Times in Washington reported on a quarrel over the music to be played at the fair. So the article stated, and I quote, "It is contended that ragtime will detract from the dignity and high character of a musical scheme such as should benefit the standard of a great World's Fair. But a question arises, is World's Fair music intended only for a few trained ears, or is it intended to please the common people? Assuming this question answers itself then, since the music is intended for the listeners rather than the players, might it not be well to give them what they want?" End quote. So I would have to agree with the author here. Why would you not play what people want to hear at a World's Fair? It was clear at this time that ragtime was popular. Even with the negative connotations, it was obviously desired by the public. So regardless of public opinion of or desire of ragtime to be played during the World's Fair, the Bureau of Music still placed a ban on its inclusion in the official fair programming. So there's a difference between what's included in the official fair programming, like in Festival Hall, basically anything past the pike. So other music could be heard along the pike. So I'm sure, you know, his music could be heard along with many others. This was kind of the place where a lot of publishers and music shops would set up kind of as a marketing, you know, if you go to a festival, that's where the vendors were.
Right. Yeah.
So that wasn't part of the official part of the fair. You mentioned John Philip Sousa. So there was some accounts that he was commissioned to play some of Joplin's pieces. As of yet, that is actually not true. Mm-hmm. So there's that. I've also read places where John Philip Sousa actually had some contempt for ragtime as well. But in January 1904, Ernest Kroger, the guy from the Bureau of Music I mentioned earlier, stated, "Ragtime is like measles, contagious. It would demoralize the whole program because when people hear a few airs of this sort, they want more," end quote. So, thus the fair opened April 30th, 1904, with no ragtime and people were not happy. Richard and Iris Schwartz researched the bands that were played at the St. Louis World's Fair, and they have a whole publication. We have it upstairs. They found that by May of 1904, the ban had been lifted by, and I quote, "pleas made by the guardians of the baton," end quote, and the crowds that gathered in front of the administration building on May 3rd. So then the question becomes, were Joplin pieces included at the fair? Did he attend the fair? So the first answer is yes, but at this time, only one piece of Joplin's has been uncovered as officially part of the programming. So the Veal Band of St. Louis played the Entertainer, one time, and this information was pulled from Richard and Iris Schwartz's research. But they were only concerned with the bands that were at the fair and not the other two types, which were orchestras and chorus. So further research needs to be done to find out if Joplin's pieces were included in those parts of the official fair programming. But it's interesting because the RISM music database contains one orchestrated score of Joplin's music, and it's the only one that they have of his music, and it's the Cascades. Mm-hmm. And the Cascades...
That's the one I've heard about.
Yeah, that was the piece that he wrote to commemorate the fair. So when you hear it, it kind of sounds like cascading waterfalls. The cover of the sheet music has the Grand Basin in the image. So this song kind of raises questions surrounding the fair, as there's oral histories stating that this particular piece could be heard at the fair, and in some cases that Joplin was actually there, or that he was even the one playing those pieces. So it'd be interesting to see if, you know, the Cascades was included in the orchestra portion of the programming. So circling back to whether or not Joplin made an appearance at the fair, that is highly unlikely in my professional opinion. And this is why. So traveling through most of 1904, Joplin is traveling all the time. Not to mention, he meets Freddie Alexander earlier in the year. They get married in June of that year.
Yeah, she dies when
she dies September 10th of that year.
Oh, my goodness.
So I have traced Joplin's whereabouts in newspapers from June up until Freddie's death. So, yes, maybe he could have went in May. Sure, he maybe could have went between Freddie's death and the end of December. And this is where sometimes I go a little bit out of the confines of, you know, my history hat and kind of humanize Joplin to his wife died. You know, are you going to the first thought in a person's head is probably not, man, I really need to get to that fair. You know, even though he was working so much during the time of their marriage, his music was, you know, still his central focus during this time. He's promoting, he's playing concerts any chance he could. But there are no mention of him in any newspapers that have turned up at this time, aside from people saying they heard his music there, which could be a number of things. Maybe they heard it at the Pike. You know, maybe they just thought it was his piece. I mean, there could be another of, you know, conjectures we can make here. But so far, there have not been any reliable sources that are backed up with other corroborated evidence to indicate his presence at the fair. So to conclude about Ragtime's perception at the fair, we have to make some comments on the racial elements that surround this topic. So for one, Ragtime is not viewed as serious music from social and academic standpoints. Kristen Moon did some research into this area, and she summarized the academic study of music at the turn of the 20th century really well, and I think it's very telling of what we see kind of with Ragtime. So she is quoted as saying, "Harmony, the set of principles that guide the way in which notes are combined into chords and the movement from chord to chord in a musical composition, was seen as the pinnacle of musical expression. Melody and rhythm, the other elements of music that scholars used to categorize what they heard, were perceived to be less advanced." Stating in the late 18th century, music experts had begun to racialize these three categories: harmony, melody, and rhythm, associating harmony with European art music and melody and rhythm with non-European traditions. Considering ragtime is ragtime because of the syncopated rhythm, that's where that is placed in that non-European, non-serious type of music by the academic thinking of the time. So despite Scott Joplin's desire to be considered a serious musician, as well as his desire for ragtime to be considered an African-American classical genre of music, it was not. Ragtime's negative social stigmas largely stemmed from the areas it was associated with: the body houses, saloons, seedy areas, red light districts, things of that nature. But if you think about the places where African Americans are allowed to play, it would make sense that a traditional African American form of music is going to be located in these types of areas. One serious issue with discussing how ragtime was perceived at the fair is we have to ask ourselves, whose perspectives are we looking at?
Right.
Or better yet, whose perspectives can we look at? So a big problem in the archives, especially in the subject matter we primarily research at the museum, is silenced voices. We're trying to research African-American history from the turn of the 20th century, which makes it difficult to find their perspective. Newspapers are wonderful, but the St. Louis Palladium is the only African-American newspaper in St. Louis at the time of the fair. There is a serious lack in African-American collections at the Missouri Historical Society's Library and Research Center. from a recent graduate project that myself and my coworker Heather Mall and I worked on, we discovered that out of all of the records containing information regarding the fair, only two of them were from African Americans.
Wow.
Newspaper accounts describe racial discrimination at the fair. For example, July 12th, the executive board of the National Association for Colored Women opened its fourth biannual meeting in St. Louis. The following day, the paper reported that Booker T. Washington's wife, who is the president of this association, refused to participate in the Colored Women's Day at the fair. The next day following that, the same association, and I quote, passed a resolution to withdraw the decision to hold a session at the World's Fairgrounds on July 13th, 1904, end quote. So the St. Louis Globe Democrat also reported on July 13th that an African-American regiment of the Illinois National Guard canceled their planned visit to take part in the fair, citing unfair discrimination with being refused the courtesies generally extended to visiting military companies. The regiment was asked by the U.S. military to bring their own tents and cooking outfit, which was not a requirement of other attending military companies. So, to make a long story short, it is unclear, in reality, as to whether or not Joplin attended the fair. We don't have hard and fast evidence that says yes or no. From my research, I would say probably not, a strong probability that he did not. The Palladium did encourage the African-American community to attend the fair, although many did boycott the fair because of these issues cited here. I mean, Booker T. Washington's wife was making comments on the racial discrimination at the fair. The St. Louis Fair was different in that respect than the Chicago World's Fair, which was not as racially charged as the St. Louis one. But his music was included in the official programming at least once. So we know that he was included. There were other rags included in the official fair programming as well. I know Tom Turpin was one. There were others. But there is the point, too, that marches and rags are similar. And sometimes somebody would name a rag a march to avoid some of these racial stereotypes.
And Joplin, he wrote some pieces that actually are like combination march and like, wasn't there Rosebud March? Is that
So he did have some marches. Bethina is a different, and I'm drawing a blank right now, I apologize, but there's two that are similar to Bethina that are a little bit different. His first published piece was Original Rags. But he had two published pieces before that weren't rags. So it was a march and a waltz.
Yeah. I think one was like Harmony Club Waltz. That sounds right.
Yeah. I just read that it's evading my memory again. But yes, there were two before the first rag that he published. Racial discrimination was just, you know, a large part of ragtime's beginning and its overall societal, you know, reception, mixed along with just the academic study where people just said, by this academic standard, this is less than because of this, you know, there was race elements, but it was the harmony melody, you know, that kind of thing that made them, you know, have a negative academic look.
Yeah.
So it seems ragtime was definitely more of a people's music. So can you tell us a little more about how ragtime influenced music history in general or other genres? And do you know who influenced Joplin himself?
Okay, so to quote Kristen Moon again on the early 20th century music scholarship, and quote, despite seeing non-European traditions as inferior to European ones, these scholars still believe that the study of non-European music had its merits and helped to preserve what they thought might hold the key to mapping the evolution of musical expression among humanity. And I think that quote goes really well with what you just said about ragtime, you know, being music for, you know, the people. considering my primary research focus is the surrounding neighborhood and the historical context surrounding Joplin's life, my brief explanation of ragtime's influence would be on band and jazz. Many rags were played with full bands, which then morphed into big band and swing, and then eventually jazz. So it's kind of this little progression that kind of molds in together in my mind. The use of syncopation, however, can be seen in popular music all the time, especially with hip-hop artists and rappers. The polyrhythms, the improvisation, and the syncopation, which are all common elements of ragtime, can also be seen in jazz. We see a lot of jazz improvisation and polyrhythms, and also freestyle rap, with that improvisation and things like that.
So Jess, I'm sure you get lots of questions when visitors come here. So what would be some of the more common questions that you get? And, you know, there's a 1977 movie about Scott Joplin's life, which apparently those have got a lot of myths as well about Belle Jones, and also that Joplin had a baby daughter as well.
Yes. Yes. So those are all fun. We don't get a whole lot about the movie. I think more people mention, you know, the sting, which I like to say, you know, is kind of the big jumping off point for the ragtime revival in the 70s. I have not seen said movies, so you know, it's that. But one big conundrum we face is the story of Belle. So The narrative of Belle marrying Joplin comes primarily from oral histories with his friends from Sedalia. Arthur Marshall was the primary person for this narrative, and it came from Rudy Blesch and Harriet Janis's 1950s publication, They All Played Ragtime. So that was kind of the first big publication about Joplin and ragtime, that had come about. But, you know, there's, when I mentioned earlier about the difficulty doing this research, there's just not a lot there. And especially when Blesch and Janis were doing this research, they couldn't access information like we can now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they did rely very heavily on these oral histories, which are amazing to have. But as, you know, museum professionals and information professionals, we know that what comes with the difficulties of these oral histories. They're interviewed many years after the event. So the story of Belle is problematic on several accounts, but mainly because the timelines just don't seem to match up. Much of this research begun with the late Brian Cather and our current co-worker, Katie Tobin. So Katie's ongoing research has thus far discovered 7 inconsistencies between the documented evidence and they all played ragtime. So the first one is they claim Belle Jones Hayden, and Belle is supposed to be in relation to Scott Hayden. So Belle and Scott married in Sedalia before coming to St. Louis. So far, there are no documents found supporting this claim. And there are claims that Belle and Scott moved to St. Louis together in 1900. I believe our video talks about Belle and Scott living together. The upstairs was interpreted as it was just the two of them living there. And to derail for just a second on that, that whole Belle and Scott living here together just really doesn't make sense in terms of local context. What is going on at the time frame? We're talking about 1900. We're talking about a heavily populated area of St. Louis. We're talking about boarding houses are, you know, a big thing. Why would an African-American musician, now musicians don't make a lot of money in general, right? I mean, he's not Kanye West here. So, you know, I mean, why would him and his so-called wife rent an entire floor in one of the most heavily populated areas of the city at the time? So we did more research into this and found that, well, that is correct, because he didn't live up there by himself. There was another family actually living there, the Watts family. And so we have done a reinterpretation of the upstairs now, because Joplin was actually more of like a boarder. He rented a space. He did not rent the whole floor. The rent prices around the area at the time were not super low. They weren't astronomical, but you know, it would have, and he wasn't a down and out musician either. I mean, he wasn't super wealthy. He did well. He lived comfortably, especially for the time period, but not renting an entire floor in St. Louis kind of deal. So we have now appropriately interpreted the space, you know what I mean? So getting back to them moving together, we've not found Bell listed with Scott or alone in St. Louis. The only listing that involves both of them comes from a 1900 census in Sedalia, showing that they both took lodgings in the same building. So that, to me, is not enough evidence to say they're married because they took lodgings.
Right.
So Blush and Janice were the first to mention Bell's prior husband, who was Joe Hayden, who was the elder brother of Scott. So there's not been a listing found for a Joe or a Joseph Hayden. His mother is listed in the census of having 7 children. One census in 1900 lists 4 alive, then in 1910 only 3, but still no mention of a Joe. Hayden would also have had to have been the 8th child. So is it possible he is being mistaken for Scott Hayden's elder brother Charlie or Ernest? So that's where this research is still, you know, continuing to grow and to morph into other things. The next is the book claims that Bell and Scott rented this 13-room house in a 1903 at the address 2117 Lucas Avenue, which I need to correct myself earlier. I said Locust. It's Lucas. I apologize for that mistake. So records do indicate that Joplin roomed at the 2117 Lucas address with his 2 brothers, but there's still no listing for Bell. Will's wife, so Will is Joplin's brother, her name is Sophie Nora. She also lived there along with Nora, who was Scott Hayden's wife. Mm-hmm. So maybe we're thinking of some mixtures here. So the book also claims that around 1905, there is tension in the Joplin house due to the birth and death of an ill infant. This conflicts with the marriage and death of Freddie Alexander, who Arthur may be mixing up in this case. There was accounts of an infant death to somebody that he was friends with. So quite possibly that, you know, got into the narrative in that way. The book then claims that Scott separated from Belle in around 1906 and that she died in around 1907. This is the year that Joplin went to Chicago and stayed with Arthur Marshall. But this would also conflict with his marriage to Freddie. And there's good reason to believe that Bell died in 1930. So Will and his wife, Sophie Nora, split up in 1904. Could Marshall maybe be remembering a mix of 3 different women as Bell? That's possible. So the book also claims to have used the words of Reverend Alonzo C. Hayden, but does not mention that Bell was his mother, or doesn't use him at all to detail Bell's life. Did he know who he was? Or that in 1900, he was one of 3 children she had born and the only living. So it's just strange that there's no mention of this, you know, in that manner. So we're still kind of doing more research into that area. But at this time, you know, that is the evidence that has been able to be uncovered.
Yeah. Thanks for clearing that up for us.
So outside of the myths you have to dispel, I'm sure, many of times, what do you feel guests take away when they come here and visit or, you know, think about with ragtime history?
Yeah, so in general, guests come away with more of the historical context in which Joplin and ragtime existed. You know, we don't want people to think that, you know, these things exist in a background or in a vacuum, that there's, you know, other things that come into play here. So we're not just this ragtime museum. We don't claim to be, despite our name. We're also not just concerned only with Joplin himself. Understanding that context in which he lived and worked is vital for broadening a deeper understanding of concepts. It is my sincerest hope that after I give a tour, folks have a little bit of an understanding of why the neighborhood looks vastly different from what Joplin saw when he walked out that front door. A quantitative analysis of census records from 1900 to 1920 shows a stark decline in the socioeconomic status of the residents between the city block the museum sits on and the one directly across Del Mar Boulevard, which used to be Morgan. To demonstrate a brief background of the Jeff Vanderloo neighborhood, which is the area that we are in, it began around the mid-1850s as a primarily German and Irish immigrant community. During the 1890s, we start to see these two-family flats being subdivided into four-family flats to accommodate the rising population. And more of the affluent individuals began to move areas further west toward gated communities, such as in University City, which many of them are still standing today. I've even traced individuals from this exact area over to those gated communities in U City. The 1900 census for these two city blocks showed the most diversity in its history, which is pretty awesome. The racial breakdown is almost half and half between the white and black residents, with 12 individuals actually owning their homes, which then decreased down to only two by 1920. The 1907 Comprehensive Urban Renewal Plan is the first to mention the area around Mill Creek Valley. And Mill Creek Valley was a prominent African-American community around Market Street, which is just a few blocks towards the highway from here. So I kind of call this like unincorporated Mill Creek Valley, because it's like right outside of that boundary line. So this plan talked about the area to be a blighted area of the city, and what were they going to do to make St. Louis great again. So city planners, mainly old white middle-class men, discussed ways to better the city, such as more gated communities and more parks. And in the report, they commented, you know, on how they were a group of peers that were going to make the best decisions for the city. But you notice they did not ask anyone from the community in which they are discussing. So these conversations continue to be had. And in the sake of not going on for 10 years, we're going to fast forward to the 1950s, when interstate highway travel was now a necessity for the white middle-class folks that were living in the suburbs, but needing to commute to the city for work. So Mill Creek Valley was completely destroyed to make way for Highway 6440, displacing the entire community of individuals who called the neighborhood their home. Mill Creek Valley was one of the St. Louis prominent African-American neighborhoods, similar to the Ville in North St. Louis, if you've heard of the Ville. So jobs go, people go. You know, this is not a time when everyone has a car, even in the 50s. Still in the 50s, most households, you know, if you were middle class, you had one maybe. That was not the case in this area by the 50s. When all of the people go, these houses are left abandoned. Old houses left abandoned are eventually going to crumble, which does present safety issues for the surrounding community. Abandoned houses are also breeding grounds for crime. So typically in areas where you have more abandoned buildings, you have more crime in the area. So many of the surrounding buildings were torn down in the 1960s and 1970s, which was also the time period when Mackler Shepherd spearheaded the Jeff Vanderloo Incorporated, which was like a grassroots effort to revitalize this area. And Mackler Shepherd was instrumental to that movement. I've heard some historians call the whole thing a failure, and in my mind, it was a huge success. He brought the Brown Shoe Company to the area, which gave a lot of jobs to people. You know, there was really a lot of things that were starting to be very positive, and then the Brown Shoe Company left, and again, when those jobs go, you know, people go. Things like that. And so today we are left with the remnants of city neglect. And in the case of our museum specifically, the state of Missouri neglect.
So it's quite amazing that the house even survived.
And what's interesting about that is it almost didn't. So it was slated for demolition. And the story goes, we don't have any evidence for this, so we always say, you know, that it is a story, but somebody spray painted "Scott lives here" lived here on the building, and they looked into it, and sure enough, found in the 1902 city directories, he was indeed in this location. And that is what really also started this grassroots effort to start preserving this place. And the Jeff Vanderloo Incorporated had a lot to do with that. And they ended up contacting the Department of Natural Resources, you know, to get more funding, because preserving these buildings is really expensive. So Department of Natural Resources then took over, and that's how we were able to preserve the building and then turn it in to a museum. So we preserve the history of Scott Joplin and Ragtime, but more importantly, it is a representation of the historical background of systemic racism in St. Louis and a prime example of how African-American voices are continuing to be silenced in archives and other information agencies, despite the fact that we are a government state-sponsored site. We are part of the state of Missouri as the Missouri Department of Natural Resources. And up until recently, when they opened up a new museum for an African-American during the Civil War, we were the only site that focused on African-American history in the entire Missouri State Parks system. Mm. Sad. Yes, it is very sad. So the historical trajectory of the Jeff Vanderloo neighborhood and Mill Creek Valley and surrounding areas should be preserved for future generations, so they may have access to these records that represent their community, so they have a voice. The state of Missouri needs to be better stewards of its collections and put more energy into the proper care of our collections. Timely attention to our institutional documents, such as our collection management plan, and ensuring the proper upkeep of buildings under its care. By not ensuring the proper resources are allocated for staff members to further research and properly reappraise, accession, deaccession, and describe the collections, the Department of Natural Resources is doing a severe disservice to the taxpayers that fund its department. By not making the collections openly accessible to the public, it defeats the entire purpose of having an archive in the first place. They exist to be used. Currently, we have a room full of stuff that does not have a uniformed way it is cataloged into the system. And we have a collection management plan that was drafted in 2017 and has yet to be cleared by the state. Our current mission statement is from 1999, as our new mission statement is part of said collection management policy.
Wow. So, thank you for such a passionate answer.
Yes.
What is something, I guess for our last question, something you wish more people knew about Scott Joplin when they come here?
Yeah, so because of the research that I did over the summer with, you know, tracing him during the fair, I really found how much he self-promoted himself to get his music out there. And I guess as long as I've been doing this, I never really thought about him in that way. And thinking about, oh my gosh, think about the time period, you know, he traveled the Midwest from town to town, you know, selling sheet music, performing concerts. He was playing a concert in a town 30 miles away from Sedalia the night before Freddie died. I mean, he is on it. You know, she died from tuberculosis. She had to have been bedridden those last, you know, couple days. And records indicate that, you know, she was in, you know, in bed. But he knew he had to do whatever it took if he wanted to make it, you know, considering the racial issues at the time, you know, just how information gets from place to place at the time. Even with a publisher as well known as John Stark, John Stark was a big deal. He still put the footwork in himself, totally DIY style, which is awesome in my opinion.
Very good.
Yeah. Excuse me. He got on the trains. He picked the towns. He walked into the shops. He booked the concerts. Considering, again, the time period, that's just downright impressive to me. He wanted to be taken as a serious musician and for a Ragtime to be considered an African-American classical genre of music. And I really wish people would know that, because, you know, Ragtime is fun. You want to dance. It's, you think of it in a, you know, in a bar where people are having fun and, you know, it's lighthearted. And he really wanted it to be, you know, like the next Bach, Chopin, you know, things like that. I think on one of his pieces, there's a comment on there that says something like, as good as Chopin or something, like mentions his name. I'm losing the exact words right now, but so they're kind of trying to make that, you know, connection there. Just didn't really stick. But Ragtime is incredibly complicated to play. Scott Joplin was brilliant. He was known to be humble, and he did not let the incredible hurdles in his life stop him from becoming the king of ragtime. I really wish people knew how much effort he put into this, and that if people nowadays think they're so oppressed and they can't get somewhere and they just can't even,
they should consider how what Scott Joplin
had. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, how good they have it now compared to a young black American ragtime musician in 1903.
Right.
You know, I mean, that for Scott Joplin to become what he became in that time period, and people knew him back then. I mean, no, he didn't get the big notoriety that I think he really wished he could get. I mean, I think most artists wish they were recognized more than they are.
It's a shame, yeah. Tree Manisha didn't, like, really become much of a success, not until the 70s anyway.
Yeah, and that is such a sad story, too, because, you know, he wrote that around 1913. And that was really when the syphilis was really starting to take hold. And so it's deteriorating his brain. So he ends up going crazy and he dies in an institution in New York. So we kind of had, like, you know, this rags to kind of riches to rags story in a way.
Right.
You know, he's buried without even a grave marker. It ended up being placed in the 70s during the ragtime revival. You know, and I don't know exactly why that wasn't that way. Again, you could speculate different things. Now, his wife, Lottie, so he's married to Freddie. There's a marriage certificate for that. And then Lottie was used to be considered a common law marriage. But Brian Cather actually found the marriage certificate between Lottie and Scott Joplin by searching online, found it in a New York archive. So that just goes to show the more things that get digitized, the more we're going to be able to keep furthering this research and keep dispelling, you know, those myths. But Lottie did outlive him. And so, I mean, I'm assuming there were medical bills to pay. So, you know, who knows? But it is just kind of sad because Tremonish is amazing and he did not get to see that, you know, kind of come to fruition. He actually put in a lot of footwork to have it played in New York, had all the actors and actresses, you know, ready to go. And the rug got pulled out from under him last minute from the venue, didn't get to put it on. And then, you know, he ends up dying in 1917. So, you know, that's just, you know, a really sad story, but, you know, Scott Joplin is an incredible story. It's just a, you know, a huge testament to, you know, what hard work and, determination and not taking no for an answer can do. But I really wish that, people also knew about other ragtime musicians as well. I mean, I know we're the Scott Joplin Museum, but, you know, he's not the only ragtime musician, and there's other folks that, you know, published amazing things. Tom Turpin, Louis Chauvin, Joe Jordan, Arthur Marshall, James Scott, Scott Hayden, you know, on and on. Most people don't even know what ragtime is.
Yeah.
You know, I wish that people knew more about this genre and that it would be played in more venues around town, you know, like jazz and blues are. I mean, we live in St. Louis. We are a fantastic city for music. There's, you know, different genres playing any night of the week. So it'd be really cool to see, you know, some more of that. And also that the entertainer is not just the ice cream truck song.
Yeah.
So that's all I got.
Well, thank you, Jess, so much for all your time and dedication.
We really appreciate it.
It was great.
Yeah, absolutely. I really appreciate the opportunity to share this information with you all. And I would like to encourage anyone listening to come visit us at 2658A Del Mar Boulevard.
Yeah, what are the hours?
So we open back up February 1st to the public. We have limited availability in February, just meaning we aren't open on Mondays through the month of February, but we are back open full-time in March until the 1st of November. So we're open from 10 to 4. We do tours at the top of every hour, taking our last one at 3, and we are closed on Sundays.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.